Hey, welcome to the Dollar Bin Studio. This is Adam, and you are listening to part two of the Tom DeFalco Ron Friends interview. What you're about to hear is going to start out with a bunch of giggling and rambling. For those of you who are curious about what's with all the giggling and rambling, go ahead and listen to part one of this interview. And for those of you who haven't listened to part one and you're starting on part two, I wonder why. But nonetheless, you will enjoy. So go ahead and continue to listen. And when you're done, go ahead back and listen to part one. This interview was recorded. Later on, you'll hear Ron and Tom talking about their Spider-Girl miniseries, which is coming out. Now, I'd like to point out that this interview was recorded months ago, and when I say months ago, I mean back before Heroes Con. So the series, the Spider-Girl miniseries of which they speak of, has already come and finished. That means you can go to your local comic shop and pick up all of the issues of the miniseries all in one go. I highly recommend it. It's an entertaining story. I myself saw it at Heroes Aren't Hard to Find in Charlotte. I saw it on their kids rack. I know Richard's Comics and Collectibles. He carries it, so if you're in Charlotte or the Greenville area, I recommend as soon as you're done listening to this to go by one of your shops. Hell, go by your local comic shop and ask them if they have it. Go ahead and pick up the series. It's only a few issues, and it's fun the entire way through. Just a little bit more recent news. Spider-Girl apparently will be continuing, or it's going to be another miniseries. It will not be Tom DeFalco and Ron Friends. It's a different creative team. I'm too lazy to go look it up. However, if you are interested in more Tom and Ron, they again have a new series coming out, which is the renewal of Thunderstrike, another series you'll hear us talk about a little bit in this interview. So we were all kind of looking forward to that, and what do you know? New Thunderstrike mini coming up. Anyway, that's enough of me. Let's get on to the hilarity.
Stand a little bit in the same vein, and hopefully a little less vile, venomous.
Venomous? What?
a lot of the interviews we've done recently all have kind of a common denominator, and that's working under Jim Shooter as he was editor in chief. Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences with him, because he seems like a guy that everybody kind of has a different view of.
Well, most people's view is up his nose because he was a very, very tall man. So, in fact, I think that's where most of the candy was coming from. So,
Oh my God. All
I'm going to say about Jim is that he was a wonderful source of shade and income, and I love the man.
All right. I worked very closely with Jim for a lot of years. He is the guy that really got me into Marvel Comics. And I think that he's probably one of the most creative guys I've ever met. Probably the single greatest plot doctor I have ever seen in action. He had a real vision for the industry. I think that a lot of times he felt he did not get his creative due. And I think that led to, you know, frustrations on his part. I think that sometimes he had a grand idea, but the actual nuts and bolts of getting something done, you know, really wasn't his strong suit, which I think, you know, I think Jim and I made a great team because he had the vision and I could figure out how to make it work. Sometimes he could be abrasive, and like all creative people, he was very passionate about his ideas. I think he did a tremendous amount for the industry. And I think that, you know, sometimes things didn't go his way, and sometimes he reacted poorly to that, as most of us do when things don't go our way.
Why do you think he was so polarizing? I mean, there doesn't seem to be anybody that we've talked to that comes right down in the middle. It seems to be they either loved him or...
Well, it depended on what side you came down on any given situation. As Tom was saying, I mean, the guy, I mean, literally and figuratively, the guy was larger than life. And if he was on your side, which he was for a lot of us, I mean, when he came into office, I mean, you know, what he did for royalties and incentives and pay and all that kind of stuff, I mean, nobody could ever take that away from him. I mean, his impact on the industry is indisputable. But if you were working with him and came down on the wrong side of him creatively, you saw that more abrasive side. He wasn't, you know, unfortunately for a person in his position, as Tom was indicating, he wasn't much of a people person. And he needed some mitigation when it came to that kind of stuff. And so I think there are people who are very, very loyal to him, and deservedly so, because of everything he contributed. And if you got on the wrong side of him in anything, whether professionally or personally or whatever, you're going to have a different view. That's really all it is. You'll probably get the same kind of polarization even with a Stan Lee type of guy, because if you're in that position of power, people's perceptions are affected by that kind of thing. I've spent years listening to, different people, and I couldn't even name a name right now because I tend to dismiss it, but DeFalco was editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics, and in that position of power, people feel it necessary to have an opinion. And I've had, I've listened to people have bizarre opinions of what Tom meant when he said something, or what his attitude was about something, or how he comported himself on a business issue. And I'm sorry, that's not the guy I know. it never has been. But it becomes a perceptual issue. It's like I don't mean to in any way be dismissive of the entire subject, but it's kind of like when Stan supposedly looked at Iron Man and said, "I wonder what he'd look like with a nose," and somebody walked out and went, "Stan just said we have to give Iron Man a nose." And that's not what Stan said. And then ultimately Stan looked at Iron Man with a nose and went, "Who is the idiot that gave Iron Man a nose?" That kind of thing. When you're in that kind of position of power, people are freaky about it. They have the perception is, it's an all or nothing type of a perception. And I think Shooter sometimes benefits from that, but sometimes suffers from that. It's a shame. It really is, because, we're just people trying to make the best decisions we can under any given situation. And, you're right. He has become a polarizing figure, and I don't really get it myself, because I can see both sides of it. I've been on both sides of it. I've dealt with the gentleman on a one-to-one basis, and he was always a, decent person to me. Just like Tom said, you can work really well with the guy. He can be very complimentary, but he could be mercurial at times as well. So I get it. Do I get double world score for using mercurial in a sentence?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
That's pretty good.
Triple.
I worked with Shooter, like I said, for many years. We worked very closely together. There were times when we would be fighting and screaming at each other. And yet at a certain point when I was getting ready to leave the industry, I was trying to convince Shooter to come with me. I think now, I'm gonna do a pre-sale here. I'm with a couple of other former members of Marvel. I'm in the process of writing a book about our time at Marvel. So I've been doing a lot of research, the times before and that sort of stuff. And I can see how the industry was actually changing during the time of Stan Lee. The artists and writers were essentially businessmen, people just trying to do the work with a very workmanlike attitude about the material. You do the pages, you get paid, you support your family. And that's what they were thinking about. The biggest hassle with years later, did Kirby create this? Did Stan create this? Did Don Heck create this? I've got evidence that to me kind of proves that Iron Man was created by Don Heck and Larry Lieber. Because they really? Certainly did the first issue.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why nobody knows, because nobody kept records, because nobody thought these characters were going to last beyond 2 or 3 years. During that period of time, there was workmanlike attitude. During the time of Roy Thomas and the editor-in-chiefs that followed Roy, it was suddenly former fans given the keys to the kingdom. And hey, we can play with these characters and use these characters the way we always dreamed them of them when we were fans. And then when Shooter took over, it was away from the more fan attitude to a more professional attitude that, no, these characters don't belong to the creative people. They belong to a company. And I think that was a big adjustment for a lot of the creative people to suddenly, when I came in, you used to refer to your assignment as, "This is my book. These are my characters." And I think when Shooter came in, he kind of tried to bring in the attitude that this may be your assignment, but these characters belong to Marvel, and they're going to be around long after you're off this assignment.
more of a stewardship situation. Yeah.
Yeah. So you know, your job is to do the best you can with the characters, but the editors have the responsibility for safeguarding the characters for the future. And that was a major transition for a lot of creative people. And I think
a lot of pushback. Yeah.
What?
There was a lot of pushback against that, yeah.
There was a lot of pushback against that. A lot of guys left the company because they really couldn't cope with this idea that they now no longer had total control of the characters, that they had to answer to editors. So a lot of people disliked Shooter just because he was trying to bring the company into a more professional understanding. So I think a lot of people, their reactions to Shooter are based on their passions about how they related to the work. You know, during the period that, you know, Jim Shooter was editor-in-chief was a very passionate time in comics. Creative people often went to war with each other because somebody had guest-starred a villain or a character, and you know, guys would get into fist fights over this. You know, and Jim was trying to bring in, you know, a more professional attitude that, hey, guys, you know, okay, he used one of your, you know, one of the villains associated with your book. This is not a mortal sin. We're adults. We can talk about these things. You know, and I think it was a whole big transition for a lot of people to adjust to that fact that I am not the emperor. If I'm doing Amazing Spider-Man, I'm not the emperor of Spider-Man. Because there was a time where the writer of Amazing Spider-Man owned all the villains that appeared in Spider-Man and wouldn't allow them to appear in Spectacular Spider-Man or Marvel Team-Up. I mean, come on, they're Spider-Man villains. So, you know, a lot of the feelings about Shooter, I think, are era-specific because of that era and that transition where Marvel was slowly transitioning into, instead of a writer-editor-driven company, to an editor-focused company where the editors kind of gained more power. And then later, when I took over, my real goal was to make Marvel function like a real publishing company, to have like a 5-year plan and to kind of figure out what you're going to do 2 or 3 years from now. And again, that was another transitional period. So, like I say, I think people have... They look at Shooter and they blame everything, every problem they had with Marvel, they blame on Shooter. And some of them he might have been responsible for, and some of them he wasn't responsible for. I think one of the things that Shooter did, which I would say I think was wrong, is he identified so, you know, he became the face of Marvel. And that if anybody had any problem with Marvel, they immediately assumed they had a problem with Shooter. Because, you know, guys who would be arguing about rights or artwork return or whatever assume that Shooter was the bad guy.
Well, Tom, let me ask you then, knowing working so close with Shooter the way that you did, how did that influence your term as EIC? And Ron, what kind of dirt did you hear from the people working with him as far as the wild blaming? I don't know if I'm making any sense on this, but as you mentioned, you know, when you're the ESE, you get the blame and you also get the credit.
Well, and I think most of the stuff I heard, I'd be hard-pressed to give you specifics, but I think Tom just addressed it, that, you know, when an EIC is in place and becomes the face of Marvel, if somebody has a problem with Marvel or with an individual editor, it ultimately becomes crap that lands on the shoes of the EIC, you know, deservedly so or not, because the buck stops there, you know, that kind of thing. But most of the stories I was referring to were all perceptual things. It's very easy when somebody's in a position of power for other people to see him as being dogmatic or vindictive or, you know, all these different things. I mean, I would hear all these stories about Tom being Machiavellian and manipulative and backstabbing, and I have never known a more front-stabbing man in my life than Tom DeFalco. If Tom's got a problem with you, he's not going to keep it secret.
Well, you know, Ron brings up a good point. I am Italian. If I am angry at you, I come right to you face to face. I want to see your expression when I stab you.
Exactly. So when I would hear these stories, I'm going like, you just don't know the guy. That's not the guy. I mean, whatever your perception is, it's based on something other than the reality of it, because you know, it's based on your paranoia or it's based on something else, because, you know, if DeFalco has a problem with you, he'll let you know, and you'll know exactly what it is, and you'll know exactly how he feels about it. And, you know, I'm not saying he would rant and rave at you, but he's not a being Machiavellian and manipulative takes too much effort. Tom's not big on effort. It's easier to just say you're being a jackass, and that's more Tom's style, you know. And so, like I said, some of these stories I heard just they don't even jibe with who Tom is as a person, you know. So it's ridiculous stuff. I mean, it's you know, I'm just glad I'm never going to be famous enough for people to have opinions about me. But you know, what are you going to do? Everybody's got
I can tell you that on a couple of occasions, I've had people come up to me and say, "Listen, I hope we can put our problems behind us." When I was editor in chief, I always remember this one writer. Came up to me, and I saw him. I said, "Hey, how's it going?" He says, "It's going okay, but listen, I really hope, you know, we can put our problems behind us, because I'm just sorry about everything, and I just hope that we can get past everything." And I said, "So am I." And he walked away, and, you know, Mark Rumel was standing next to me, and he said, "What was that all about?" And I said, "Haven't got the slightest idea." You know? And one time I saw a guy who I had known at a couple of conventions, and he apologized too. And I said to him, you know, not for nothing, but what the hell are you talking about? He said to me, "Oh, I wrote a review in a fanzine about you that was not complimentary. And I haven't been able to sell a story to Marvel since." And I said, "Oh," I said, "how many stories did you sell before that thing?" "Well, I never actually sold anything." So I said, "You know, I got to tell you something. I never heard of that name of that fanzine. I'm sure most of my editors haven't heard of that fanzine. I don't think that's why you're not getting work from Marvel." And he goes, "Oh, really?" And I said, "Yeah, I have bad news for you. I don't think that's the reason." Now,
which is how Tom got a reputation as a soul-crushing bastard.
Well, I felt bad for the guy because I found out that he, you know, he was avoiding me at conventions because he thought I was mad at him. And it's like, you know, I assume that, you know, when I became editor in chief, which, you know, I always thought was kind of a joke, because I always thought I always thought of myself as a freelancer who was masquerading as a staff person. And right before I became editor in chief, I was, in point of fact, negotiating with an animation studio. I was about to move to California and give up comic books entirely, and, you know, and get out of the industry. I was I didn't plan to become editor in chief, but I knew that once I was, that I was just the target, and I just assumed that nasty things would be written about me. I used to say to the editors, "Look, guys, do me a favor. If you ever fire anybody and blame me, tell me about it, because I want to know when a guy calls me up to curse me out because I fired him, I want to know at least what I fired him from." And there were times where, you know, I remember one writer, he was working on two books for us, and one editor decided to fire him off that book. And then the other editor came to me, and he's a well-named, you know, a well-regarded writer. The other editor said to me, "Hey, listen, I heard that Ralph just fired so-and-so. Can I fire him too?" And I said to him, wait a minute. "Here's your chance. Why do you want to fire him?" He says, "Because he's not doing his best work." I said, "Here's your chance to maybe get this guy focused again."
Yeah.
"You call him up and you tell him that I know you just got fired off your other assignment, but I'm your guy. But I need your best work for me. I need you to really buckle down and really do the best work." And I gave the editor this big pep talk. "You could save this guy. You can reclaim him, get him to be the superstar that he used to be." And the editor got all hyped up. He says, "This is terrific." Says, "Yeah, I'm going to call him up. I'm going to give him a pep talk, and I'm sure I can get great work from him." Walks out of the room. The following week, I read a headline: DeFalco fires the writer. So I call the editor. I said, "What happened?" He says, "Well, I called him up. I gave him a pet talk. He says, 'I'm sold. I'm going to give you my best work.'" And I said, "Well, then what happened?" He said, "Well, he was late on his script, so I said, can you deliver that script by Monday? And he says, well, actually, I was thinking of going on vacation for the next 2 weeks. I'll do it when I come back. And I said, what? So what'd you do? He says, I fired the bastard.
Well, I really want to get to Thor. I know that Ron has brought it up a couple times that nobody seems to give your
Thor.
Well, at some point my phone's going to go dead, and you're going to have to call me back on a landline or something. But proceed. With the movie coming out, you know, people might want to talk to us about Thor. But you know, what do we know?
We gotta start fun, and then we bring it down for a while. And now we're bringing it back up.
Oh, okay. So we're through the dark times.
God, I hope so.
At least we're acting like we've done this before.
You're going to have to edit the misery around this thing, just in small bits. Well, let me ask you about Thor now. You know, Ron, you were saying that everybody talks about Spider-Man, nobody really talks about Thor, but really, you know, you did the big Thor number 400. You know, you changed his entire costume. You know, the second character you guys have been involved with, where you've changed the look of a major character. How did that come about?
That you're changing the character, or yeah, we had been on the book for several years already, and we never once got bored or tired or anything, but because we always just have a natural tendency to try to keep it fresh for ourselves. And one of those things was we had introduced Eric Masterson as the alter ego, and at one point Tom had come up with the idea of banishing Thor and having Eric take over, and also have his personality take over and kind of be the fill-in Thor. And he approached me with the idea. The only reason I hesitated at all is that I wanted to play with it visually before I committed to it. And because, you know, revamping a classic character like Thor, I didn't want to go too far afield, but we wanted it to look different and sleek. And Brett Breeding helped me out with the design. And as soon as we came up with something that I was happy with, I called Tom and I said, I'm on board. Let's, you know, whenever you're ready, let's do this. And it just became a lot of fun. I mean, it was just another, we had already gotten a chance to get to know Eric as the alter ego, and it was just a lot of fun in letting go of the Shakespearean dialogue, and we were kind of having fun with some of the 90s conventions at the time. We did the spoof cover, No More Mr. Nice God, and it was funny because the traditional Thor fans didn't get the joke at all. But it was, you know, it was that working with the mass market, playing off the mass market, and having fun with the readership. One of the reasons I missed the mass market is because, you know, like on Thor, we were on that book for so long, everything was fine, the sales were solid, we didn't have to worry about every 6 months whether or not we were going to have a job, as long as the editor was happy and as long as our sales were solid. So we were able to do, remember that Christmas issue we did, Tom? It was like the first ever pagan Christmas issue where we did the spoof of How the Grinch Stole Christmas and, you know, and things like that. We could do comedy issues. We could have fun. We could do little sidebars. And you weren't under the constant scrutiny of, you know, that you are now with the limited number of books and the sales being so critical and all that, because you were playing to a larger audience. And I miss that aspect of the storytelling and everything. But that just was a natural outgrowth of our own desire to keep ourselves engaged and interested and everything. But characters have an unlimited appeal. I mean, when somebody gets on a book and says, I've said everything I have to say in a 3-issue arc or a 6-issue arc or a year arc, it always baffles me, because these characters have such legs and such depth and breadth to them. There's just an unlimited number of stories to tell. I always laugh. I mean, they even said it in Iron Man. I read an article about Iron Man 2, and they said that the Iron Man canon really didn't suggest a clear way forward, so they had to come up with their own story. And yet, if you look at the trailer, everything in that trailer is out of the books. The Black Widow, Nick Fury, the red and silver armor, you know, Vanko, whether he's the Crimson Dynamo or Whiplash, both are out of the books. Justin Hammer, you know, the War Machine, the Armor Wars. It's, you know, come on, guys. I mean, it's amazing. Sam Raimi's the only one who has actually said there's nothing in those movies that wasn't in the comic books first, you know. Otherwise, it becomes this ego thing, like, what do I have to say in my voice about this character, rather than just, it's kind of tritely stating it, but Tom and I, when we would come on a book, we'd get to know the characters, we'd, hold on for dear life and enjoy the ride, and just, come up with some crazy concepts and see how the characters respond to them. As I mentioned earlier, to when Tom came on the book, I don't know how to write four, which was one of the reasons we had a talk going back to the roots of the character. What made the character unique? What's the point of view that makes the character unique? What makes the character special? His godlike point of view. We did feel that as terrific as Walt's stories were, we liked the idea of the bond to the Earth that Odin created it inadvertently himself with Don Blake, but rather than bring back Don Blake, we decided to move forward and came up with the Eric Masterson setup and gave him a mortal identity again, it just a lot of considered fun. I mean, Tom is a craft storyteller, so he approaches the stories that way. What I loved about Tom is that he was so afraid about not being able to write Cosmic that. And if you look at our first few issues, he introduced a new pantheon of gods. He introduced the Celtic gods, and we did the three or four part celestial story. That was Tom getting his feet wet. I can't write Cosmic, right. So he just dove in deep end and forced himself to sink or swim, and swam quite well, if I may say.
I'm going to tell you guys how we got on Thor. After Spider-Man, after Ron and I were fired off of Spider-Man, we kind of.
I remember vaguely being thrown off my unicorn, but this fire, I don't remember.
Okay, you were thrown off the unicorn.
Okay,
I got involved with some other things, and basically didn't write another comic book for a bunch of months. I at one point went to England for Marvel sent me to Marvel UK for a bunch of months. I came back and hadn't really been doing much comic book writing, and I was kind of thinking, maybe I'm done with comic books. I came back, and at one point I called Ron, and we're talking, and I found out that Daredevil was open. So I spoke to Ron. I said, do you have any interest in maybe, they're looking for a creative team for Daredevil. Do you have any interest in doing Daredevil? And Ron got pretty excited about it, and I said, okay, terrific. I'm going to go talk to Ralph Macchio, who's the editor, and see if he's still interested, see if he still needs somebody. I went in the next day and I said to Ralph, listen, I understand you're looking for a creative team for Daredevil. And, I think that's a comic book that I would feel confident writing. And I think Ron would do a terrific job on that. And, Ron actually drew a couple of, at least one Daredevil sample piece, which he sent to Ralph, which Ralph loved so much that he put it on his wall, and it was on his wall for years. And Ralph said, oh, man, you guys would be great on Daredevil. You'd be terrific on Daredevil. He says, but I kind of have another big problem. He says, Thor is very late. Walt is getting off the book, but the deadline, we're really hurt, and I need a couple of fill-ins. Is there any chance that you and Ron could do a Thor film for me? And I said, Thor? Let me talk to Ron and we'll see if we can come up with something. So I called Ron and said, Ralph is interested in us doing Daredevil, but he's kind of desperate. He needs a Thor fill-in. And I don't know how we came up with the story at this stage of the game, but we came up with the Thor fill-in, which was the future Thor.
Well, the first one was the Secret Wars thing. You always forget that.
Was the first one Secret Wars? Okay, we came up with the Secret Wars one because we wanted to do a fill-in. We knew that Walt's run was coming to an end, and we knew that somebody new would be assigned to the book, and we didn't want to screw anything up. So we wanted to do a fill-in that wouldn't really screw anything up. So we did one, an untold story from Secret Wars. So we did that issue, and in the course of that, I kept talking to Ralph about, ideas for Daredevil. And he said, oh, yeah, those are interesting ideas. That's pretty good. We finished up the Thor one pretty pretty quickly, and I said, so what do you think about us doing Daredevil? And Ralph said, you know, I really think you guys would do a great job, but I really do need another Thor villain. I said, okay, well, we'll see if we can come up with another one. And that's when somehow or other we came up with the idea for a future Thor. But again, it was a fill-in, something that wouldn't interfere with whoever was going to take over the book after Walt. As we finished that book, I went into Ralph and I said, have you made a decision about Daredevil? He says, yeah, yeah. He says, you know what? I want you guys to do a book for me. And I said, terrific, because we really want to do Daredevil. He says, no, not Daredevil. I want you guys to do Thor. And I said, Thor? We don't do cosmic. You know, we do street things like Spider-Man. And he goes, what, are you kidding me? You just did two issues. And I said, but those are fill-ins. They don't count. And he says, come on, you can do cosmic. And I go, you know, I don't do that sort of thing. I'm, you know, I'm a thug. I think like a thug. I got to deal with street thugs. Come on. And he goes, no. Take a shot. Try to do a cosmic story. So I called Ron. I said, I got bad news. Ralph wants us to do Thor. And Ron goes, wow, that's great news. there's a side story in this. But, you know, I said, but I don't think we can do this. I don't know how to do cosmic. So he says, yeah, come on. You just try it. And I said, okay, we'll start off. We'll do a cosmic story. And let me see if I can come up with something. And we kind of came up with this celestial story, which I don't remember if it was originally going to be a one-part story or a two-part story. I said, well, we'll see if we can do this story. You know, I pitched it to Ralph. He liked it. And then it ended up to be a three-part story. So we did that celestial story. And by the end of that, I said, hey, you know what? I think we can do cosmic. There was one embarrassing side story. Ralph decided that he wanted Ron and I to do Thor. But Sal Buscema was assigned to Thor. So I said, well, what's going to happen to Sal? And Ralph said, well, I guess we're going to have to take him off the book. I said, wait a minute. You're going to take Sal off the book? Sal Buscema
Tom, if I may, this was one of those things where Shooter was there. And because we had done the Secret War story first, Shooter had paid some attention to it and was very complimentary about the work we had done on the Untold Tales of the Secret War and liked us as a team. So when, as Ralph was talking about hiring you as the writer, Shooter said, well, you'll just go on as a team. And he said, and Tom said, what about Sal? And Jim said, well, we'll just tell him you're bringing your own penciler along. And Tom said, except that's not really true. You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I said, hey, wait a minute. I'm not
Spider-Man, but we weren't joined at the hip or anything, you know, that kind of thing. And I certainly was very sickened by the idea of, you know, Sal being cost any work because somebody, as flattered as I was, somebody wanted to give me a book. I certainly didn't want it to be at the cost of Sal, being a big, big Sal fan.
I'd said to Shooter, listen, if it's a choice between doing Thor or firing Sal, I'd rather not do Thor. because I didn't think it was fair. And also, Sal is a living legend, and a great guy and everything else. So while we were having all this discussion, because I ended up calling Ron and saying, listen, Ron, I think I'm going to get off of Thor because they want to fire Sal. And Ron was horrified by the concept, too. So we were both getting ready to walk off the assignment that we didn't really had started.
We were
started
being offered, yeah.
Yeah, and then I was talking to Shooter and Ralph, and then Jim Salakrup walked in. He says, hey, guys, I understand you're talking about Sal. We go, yeah. He goes, well, I need an artist on Spider-Man. How about I offer him Spider-Man? See if he'd rather do Spider-Man than Thor. And I said, well, ask him if he wants to do Spider-Man, because if he would rather do Spider-Man than Thor, that's fine. But don't tell him he's being forced off of Thor to do Spider-Man. So they called up Sal and said, hey, would you rather do Thor or Spider-Man? And he goes, oh, I'd much rather do Spider-Man. So he goes, okay, you're on Spider-Man now. So that solved that problem.
I want to ask about Thunderstrike, though, because it seemed like one of those books where the numbers were solid. From the sales point of view, why was that canceled?
Well, Tom, do you want me to take this one?
Yeah, I'll take this one.
Okay.
the numbers the numbers were solid because at the time it was canceled, Thunderstrike was outselling Thor and the Avengers combined. What had happened was the gentleman in charge of marketing came up with a brilliant idea. You know, I maintain this is the meeting that got me fired from Marvel. He brought me into a meeting with the head of sales and the president of the company, and he said to me, Tom, right now we are selling, we are publishing 120 titles a month. And I said, yes, we are. And he said, if we cut that down to 60 titles, would the remaining 60 titles sell twice as well? And I laughed in his face. And then I realized he was serious. And I realized the president would believe this nonsense. And you know, the head of sales. And I said, no, absolutely not. I said, guys, we are like the movie business. If there are five great movies opening up this weekend, then during the weekend, you run around and you see as many of them as you can afford to see in terms of time and money. If there are no great movies coming out this weekend, you go for pizza. If someone is reading Werewolf by Night and you cancel that book, it doesn't mean he's going to suddenly pick up Captain America. And the guy said to me, but we're producing four Spider-Man titles a month. I said, yes. He says, so if we cut that down to two, wouldn't the remaining two sell twice as many? And I said, no, because the same guys are buying all four. You know?
Right.
And he said, no, I'm convinced that if we cut down the titles, the remaining titles would sell better. And I said, listen, guys, we're publishing 120 titles a month. He says, yes, and everybody tells us that's too many titles. I said, yeah, but you got to interpret what they're saying. What they're saying is you're publishing more titles than they can buy each month. I said, when I go car shopping, I find 10 cars that I love, but I can barely afford to buy one. If you cut those titles, all that money just evaporates. And right now, we're doing 120 titles. We're making a profit on each one. Percentage-wise, the publisher, the distributor makes the smallest percentage. Then the publisher and the retailer makes the most percentage, the biggest percentage. And I said that, you know, if we cut out those titles, we're going to put a bunch of retailers out of business because they're making a big profit on those titles. Yes, they're complaining there's too many titles because it's a lot of work for them to put those titles up. But they're selling them, and they must be selling them because if we're making a profit, everybody down the line is making a profit.
I think one of the problems from the retailer point of view is with so many titles, that means they have to front a lot more money and hope that those sell to make that profit that they get.
But they were selling and they were making the profit.
Yeah. No, I understand that.
So the problem with most of the retailers is they were too short-sighted to realize how they were making their money. And they didn't realize that, yes, they have to front that money, but they didn't actually have to front that money because they didn't have to pay for those comics. At that time, they had a 30 to 60-day, you know, remit.
Yeah.
So they weren't really laying out the money for those comics. They were laying out the money that they bought, the comics they bought last month, which they already had made the profit on.
Well, so they essentially canceled one of their better-selling titles because they thought that they'd make more money on the existing titles?
Well, at that moment, they weren't going to cancel Thor, and they weren't going to cancel Iron Man, so they canceled War Machine, and they canceled Thunderstrike, and, you know, things like that. It was
a time when Marvel was just giving up money. You know, I've often thought, which was the stupidest thing Marvel did? Buy their own distributor, because that was pretty stupid.
That didn't go well.
No, because the month they announced that they bought their own distributor, sales on every title fell 40%.
Wow.
I used to say that the Clone Saga was so bad that it hurt the sales on Fantastic Four and everything else, which was, you know, a joke at the time. But later on, people said, oh, yeah, well, sales of Spider-Man used to be great before the Clone Saga, and afterwards they were terrible. Well, yeah, but Marvel bought its own distributor in between there, which knocked everything down 40%. I've often wondered if that was the worst decision they made or when they decided to cut their titles. Because if you're publishing 120 titles, you know, maybe it makes sense to buy your own distributor. I don't think it does, but maybe it does. but it certainly doesn't make any sense to buy your own distributor if you're only publishing 60 titles.
Absolutely. Retailers really prefer one order form. It makes their job a lot easier.
Yeah, that was just a total disaster there because they gave retailers a 1-2 punch that proved to be fatal for two-thirds of the retailers.
Yeah.
I thought we weren't going to talk about dark stuff anymore.
Well, now,
anyway,
too.
That's why they decided to cancel Thunderstrike for two reasons. They said to the editor, you have a choice. You can cancel Thor or Thunderstrike.
And
they also
choice.
Said, but we think you should cancel Thunderstrike. Since I had been fired as editor-in-chief, they were doing their best to distance themselves from me.
Well, let me try asking a happier question.
Okay,
now, you
try.
Two, you... try to escape the darkness. Now, you two have worked together for over 25 years now. We're just like right at 25 years. How you two work together changed? I mean, has it basically, I bet at this point, one of you could finish the other one's sentences. You're so comfortable with each other.
No,
that would be, that
I can't
would be
stand
incorrect.
The guy.
I find
we live in separate cities because we don't like each other.
Exactly. I find him much more tiresome than I did 25 years ago. Of course, through this interview, I'm finding out that he got me fired off of some major assignments, too. I didn't know Ausley offered us our own book, and, you know, and Tom shoved it up his ass. Never mind. And I didn't know that Thunderstrike got canceled because they were trying to distance himself from Tom. I guess he really always has been the anchor everybody told me he was, and I just was too blind to realize it.
The main thing is... You know, I believe that these days Ron does more and more of the work. I just get to sit back and I say, you know what, Ron, you know what we should do? And he goes, I know, we'll bring back the Hobgoblin. And I said, yeah, but this time we should, I know, we'll have him do this and this and that. Yeah, I think that's okay. But maybe he should. And Ron goes, and then he can do this, this and that. And I go, yeah, that sounds okay. And he goes,
I'm glad you thought of it.
The truth is, the closest
what do you think I should do next? And I said, well, why don't you start drawing it?
Stop it, Tom.
And if you have any ideas for dialogue, put it in.
Tom, your unicorn needs to go out for a run. The closest it comes to that is that I will constantly annoy Tom, sometimes two or three times a week, when I get ideas. And I will throw everything at the wall. He's made me feel very welcome and pitching ideas all the time. I'll pitch the idea, and I'm always way ahead. I'm always too far ahead of where we are in the storyline and everything. And Tom will use no idea before it's time. Occasionally, when it comes time to plot an issue, I'll get the, you know, I'll say, what is coming up next? And he said, well, I thought we'd do that thing you talked about, but I thought we'd go this way with it. And I'm going, oh, cool, that sounds neat, you know, that kind of thing. So we do both very much contribute ideas, and it's a lot of fun that way. And it comes just, it comes from a comfort thing. It comes from being comfortable in pitching stupid ideas and knowing that we'll weed them out. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. So Ron and I approach each story with, you know, totally without ego. Sometimes one of us will say, you know, how about we do a story about this? And then we just start throwing every stupid idea against the wall. And the stories somehow or other start to take a shape and then start to evolve as we're throwing the ideas against the wall.
Yeah.
And then by the time they're done, you know, I always look at them and have no idea who came up with what, really don't care if we've got a good story.
It's very mutual that way, yeah. I mean, and you have to be comfortable, you know, it's kind of a recurring theme with us, is that no ego thing, because you have to be, one, you have to be generous with ideas, and two, you have to not get married to anything, and you have to be open to the back and forth. It's a collaborative medium, and you have to be open to that back and forth. And if I pitch an idea, if Tom likes it, he'll say he likes it. If he doesn't like it, he'll tell me why, and I'll go, oh, yeah, good point. Is your problem with that a storytelling thing, or is that not fair to the audience? And he goes, that's what I was thinking. Okay, cool, you know. Unfortunately, you do meet these people that, you know, have one idea every 6 months and guard it very jealously, and are very defensive about it because it's almost they're acting like they're not going to have another one if they need it. And you have to be willing to entertain the bad ideas with the good ideas and weed them out. It's nice to be comfortable enough with a creative person that you can go ahead and pitch it. And, I mean, how many times, Tom, have I called you in the morning and said, I had this thought last night, and I'm going, but now as I say it out loud, it sounds really asinine. Is that as bad as I think it is? And you'll go, eh, okay. You know, that kind of thing.
I think we could use it. What if we do this?
Yeah, so you know, that kind of thing. But it really is one of those things where, you know, sometimes you really do need to say it out loud to see if it even plays for you anymore. You know, it's a crazy thing.
Yeah, that's happened with both of us, where I start to describe something to you, and then I burst into laughter and say, boy, does this suck. It sounded better in my head.
Well, occasionally it's been something like, yeah, Tom, that was a great idea when we did it in 4 or 5 years ago. Seriously? Yeah. Never mind.
It sounds almost like you two work in the old Marvel-style method from the 60s.
Very much so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But not to the degree that Tom never just calls me up and says, we're going to do Thor, you know, we're going to do... we're going to do Hobgoblin this issue, like supposedly Stan and Jack occasionally would. It's never to that degree, but when it comes to the initial idea, we do pitch things into the pot, and by the time they get pulled out, nobody cares where the initial idea came from. But Tom always structures it as a plot and always contributes, you know, that kind of solidity and that kind of structure to it. Which, you know, I mean, even ideas that have been, you know, like a single issue concept, that's something that I pitch to him. Occasionally, it's been something a little more personal to me, or something that's just going to be a 22 page enclosed story, and I'll pitch it to him. But you can hand it over to Tom, knowing that he's going to service it as he's going to structure it correctly. He's going to give it, you know, he's going to put the beginning at the beginning, the middle in the middle, and the end at the end, and make sure that all the themes are entertained and fulfilled and you know, he takes care of all that labor that's involved in writing that is so much more than just coming up with an idea, which is unfortunately what a lot of amateurs don't recognize, is that, you know, as Tom has said, you know, it's not about coming up with one good idea for a story. You need 5, 10, 20 good ideas to get through the first 5 pages. And it's, you know, a concept is a very greasy thing, because you have to hammer it into shape. It has, at some point, craft has to take over, and it's not just grinding a creative axe for 22 pages and saying, aren't I a genius? You know, I mean, that's just not the way it works, not practically.
Yeah, if anything, I'm an anal retentive structurist. I believe that everything should be hammering the theme of the particular issue home. And structure the shit out of these things.
Well, and that was, I mean, just recently we had a conversation where I came up with something that would have been a twist. And even as I said it, you know, Tom goes, I said, that would be unfair to the reader, wouldn't it? And he went, yeah, that we'd be pulling that out of our ass. And that would be unfair to the structure of the story and to the reader. And I went, nah, you're right. I got you. You know.
So if, aside from Ron's talent as an artist, I think that the magic that we have together is that we are two idea factories. On any given day, somebody, you know, could call me up and say, do you have an idea for a Captain America story? And I'd say, no. Do you need one? And the guy would say, yes. And I'd say, how many pages? 14 and a half. And I'd, 14 and a half? And, yeah, 14 and a half. And I'd go, all right, well, let me call you up tomorrow. And somehow or other, by tomorrow, we would have a Captain America story 14 and a half pages long. You know, I maintain that, you know, what our strength is, that we can be creative on demand and on deadline, and it almost doesn't matter. Something Ron said earlier, and I will say it also, for assorted reasons, we've been very, very lucky, and I only do assignments if I can believe in it 100% and if I can give 100% to the assignment. And if I can't, if I look at the assignment and say, you know, I just can't get into this universe, I just don't believe the characters, or I don't want to believe the characters, or I just don't accept this, I'm lucky because I can pass on the assignment. You know, this is just not for me. So, you know, I only do things that I totally believe in. And I'm lucky because I love the medium, so I can totally believe in a Spider-Girl story, an American Dream story. Ron and I have done an Archie story together because I can totally believe in those characters. You know, I can totally commit myself to it, you know, so I don't know where I'm going with this.
I love the fact you said the 14 and a half pages because in the first two issues of Spectacular Spider-Girl, we do a five-page backup. One is American Dream and the other one's going to be The Buzz. And they tell complete stories in five pages, beginning, middle, and end. There's an arc, there's a theme, there's a all the stuff that should be in a story is there. And it was such fun doing the short form. I just loved doing the short form. And it's one of these things now where when you're talking decompression and you're talking 12-issue arc to do three conversation scenes and stuff, you know, if you told somebody, can you give me an American Dream story in five pages, they're going, you're out of your mind. You know, sometimes they do whole issues that are like previews of an upcoming miniseries, and nothing happens in the issue, you know, because it's a preview, you know. Mm-hmm. And but we told an action story, a mystery story, and, you know, you get to know the character. You recap her origin and get to know the character in five pages, I swear to God. It was fun as heck. And, you know, that's part of just understanding the form and realizing that everything else is just ego and add-on and silliness. You know, I mean, we have been, you know, lucky. Every time we think we're dry, you know, we come up with something that really gets us going again. And, you know, ideas come from that's a very elusive thing, like where do your ideas come from? Because, you know, we're playing in the coolest universe known to man. And each story suggests another story, you know, each element, like Asgard is a world of its own that suggests dozens and dozens and dozens of stories and on and on and on. You know, each character has his own, his own world that you can explore. I don't know where ideas come from, but you have to be free to throw them out there and see if we can hammer it into something, too. But
Now, I have... And guys, you have been just really generous with your time tonight. I do appreciate you answering all the fanboy questions that we've had. I just have one question left that I'd like to ask. You two have worked together for almost 25 years.
You keep saying that. What has been the biggest?
Well, it's just there are very few combinations of writer and artist who manage to.
Nobody else will work with us, okay? Nobody else will work with us. Paul Ryan went to do Phantom. Thank God I'm away from DeFalco. You know, Roger Stern won't return my phone calls. Dan Juergens hated my guts. I mean, nobody else will work with us. Is that what you want to hear? Fine.
Well, apparently, from what I've heard, Tom's been sabotaging your career for years.
Well, I just found that out myself tonight. So thank you to the dollar bin for darkening my world. But anyway.
Well, you guys still have Sal Buscema working with you.
Well, yes. Sal Buscema has been a boon to this title. He is... I can't begin to tell you what it's like working with a guy who has been such an idol to me and finding out that he's just an incredible gentleman and a wonderful source of inspiration. I tell everybody, when I was 8 years old, I wanted to grow up and become Sal Buscema. Now I'm far older than eight, but I still want to grow up and someday be Sal Buscema. The guy is just amazing, just an incredible man.
Well, what I would like to know is in all the years that you've worked together and all the stories that you've done, what has been the biggest disagreement that you two have had?
I mean, as far as story-wise.
Yeah, have you ever had a real big... Yeah, I mean, as far as story-wise or something one of you wanted to do that the other one didn't?
Well, one of them was... Tom didn't want to do this interview. And I said, Tom... He said, Ron, if you make me do this interview... I'm going to sabotage your career again, and I didn't know what he meant.
I think those were my exact words.
But anyway, I don't know, Tom. They actually asked us this question one other time. Did we come up with anything the last time? I can't remember. Because Danny Fingeroth asked the same question when he interviewed us in his magazine, and I can't think of a major creative dispute we've had.
No, sometimes we throw out ideas. I remember one time I said to Ron when we were on Spider-Man, hey, I got this idea to do this thing called the Spectacular Spider-Kid. And Ron said, the spectacular spider kid. What are you, out of your mind? And I said, it really, Ron. And I started to describe the you know, I forget the character's name, Ollie.
Ollie Osnick. The one that had been the junior Dr. Octopus and stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and then I started to describe it to Ron. And Ron goes, you know what, that could be kind of cool. And, you know, and then he threw in his two cents and made it a real story. And,
holy shit.
You know, it actually turned out right. You know, I think when I first said to Ron, yeah, I want to do a what if, you know, what if there was a spider girl? I think your first reaction was let's call her Spider Woman.
Yeah, because I was going with the one nobody, there wasn't an active Spider Woman at the time, but I was also going with the idea that even though Pete was a kid, he called himself Spider Man. And I said, well, what about Spider Woman? And Tom said, no, that, you know, that character's been done to death. There's more than one Spider Woman, and the title never really stuck. So let's go with Spider Girl. And, you know, you have to get used to that stuff. I mean, even character names that I come up with, you still have to try them on and get used to them. Remember the Buzz?
Because, you know, every character name really is kind of goofy. I mean, Green Goblin, Dr. Doom.
One of my favorites was the Buzz. Because, you know, we played with that name for I don't know how long, and for months we would refer to the character as the Buzz, if that's what we end up calling him. And then by the time we actually did the story, it was, you know, there was no way we were going to call him anything other than the Buzz, but it was we qualified it for months when we would have phone conversations, you know. I mean, the Buzz, unless we come up with something better, you know, that kind of thing, so...
This question has been asked to us a number of times. Have you ever had a major creative disagreement? And I don't think we have, you know, really have creative disagreements.
I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but I think when you work from the craft, when it's not an arbitrary thing, I mean, there's never been something where, like, I've given an idea and Tom says, we're not going to do that because I'm the writer, goddammit. I'm sorry, you're going to have to bleep all that, I guess. But anyway, he's never...
He's obviously
never
you
taken
haven't
that
heard the
kind
show.
You know, since we both work from the craft, there's always a practical reasoning going on. There's always an objective goal and an objective viewpoint going on. So it's never been, I'm the writer, we'll do it this way. I'm the penciler, I wanted to do it that way, or anything that could cause that kind of friction. Because, you know, as I said, Tom has a bit of the teacher in him, and I think we're lucky in the regard that, you know, we do respect each other's input enough that there's never a sense that one's being undervalued by the other or in any way devalued. And so you pitch an idea, and if Tom doesn't like the idea, he'll tell you why, and you'll work with it. You know, you'll tweak it. Or, you know, if I think an idea is really worth something, then I'll answer his problems with it and repitch it. See, what do you think of that? You know, that kind of thing.
It goes back the other way, because sometimes I've said ideas to Ron and he's going, I'm not really sure that, you know, that works because of this reason, that reason, the other thing. The strangest thing about us is we both have a tendency to laugh at ideas, but we tend to laugh at our own ideas more than we laugh at each other's ideas.
It's just a matter of what's going to work in the story. You know, I'm trying to think of if there's anything that I've even, like, resented Tom's response to it. The one idea, I guess we can talk about it now because it's a dead issue. I really wanted to do, you guys, if you followed the MC2, remember in J2, he did Julie the Gangster Gorilla? Julie the Gangster Gorilla? I thought it would be cool to introduce Big Julie the Gangster Gorilla into Spider-Girl continuity, but not so much as Big Julie the Gangster Gorilla, but I always thought it would be kind of cool to have this talking gorilla dude, but rename him Silverback, because I thought that was a cool name. I wanted to draw gorillas. I thought we could do a gorilla in a pinstripe suit and make it scary, you know? Tom disagreed, and we went back and forth all the time on this thing. I just kept saying, if we're going to do a gang war, let's do Silverback. And he'd go, Ron, you know, and it never came to blows. It never came to an argument of any kind because I understood where Tom was coming from. He created the character, for crying out loud. And if he, as the writer, didn't think that was something that was going to work, you have to respect that. I mean, there's just no two ways around it. And what ended up happening was another book, a self-published book, an independent comic, did a gorilla character named Silverback. And I went, as soon as I saw that, I went, well, then I've, you know, there's no way anytime in the next few years I'm going to do a gorilla character called Silverback. We missed the boat because we wouldn't have been the first one doing it. And it was that FX character that gentleman self-publishes that Byrne did. For those who care. Anyway. But I saw it. I said, so any gorilla named Silverback is off the table. But I read that book, and I saw what they had done with the character, and I saw what direction they went with it. And the name, I still really, 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 really like the name. So if you're, are you guys currently reading Spider-Girl?
Yes.
Hello?
I'm not convinced.
I'm not either.
Actually, I'm rereading.
We're being interviewed by three people, and I heard like a half a yes. What is going on here?
I was reading it for a while.
If it makes you happy, absolutely.
Somebody is reading Spider-Girl.
You guys should be reading Spider-Girl. I mean, you're obviously fans of our stuff. Read Spider-Girl.
I think a lot of it came down to us being sad that it was canceled and then brought back and then canceled and brought back and et cetera. Regardless, I'm going to, you know, you promised this wasn't going to get dark again. Anyway. What? I think we know why we're being canceled again. But anyway, there is a character currently in the continuity, a gang lord from before time, who is an older guy now who's been brought back into action, and his name is Silvio Baraka, and they always called him Silverback because he was the 500-pound gorilla. he was one of Wilson Fisk's guys and all this kind of jazz. And you know, so I, not only did I get a chance to use the name Silverback to my satisfaction, but the character himself is based on Sal Buscema. Sal's birth name is Silvio. And Silvio Baraka is a caricatured version of Sal, because if you ever have the pleasure of meeting Sal Buscema, he actually, if you read the stories, you'll really enjoy them, honestly, guys. He has two thugs, Guido and Nunzio, and Sal always would joke about Guido and Nunzio. You know, if you give him, like, if you challenge him in bowling, he'll have Guido and Nunzio break your knees, you know, that kind of thing. So when I came up with Silverback and wanted it to be based on Sal, he started talking about Guido and Nunzio, and I said, oh, that's cool. Okay, well, I'll use them in the story. You know, so I designed his two henchmen, Guido and Nunzio, and, of course, based them on Tom and myself. And so we're having, you know, had a lot of fun that way. But, again, that was so the whole idea of using, you know, Big Julie the Gangster Gorilla was something that I still, to this day, I think we could have made it work. But you know, it was not to be, and I don't begrudge Tom that at all. And you know, he had his reasons, and they were, and I'm sure they were legitimate. And we'll never know who would have been right, but I still got to tell my story anyway. So everybody's happy, you know.
The good news is we have a creative disagreement.
On what?
Well, now in my defense, though, about not reading Spider-Girl currently, the fact that they keep restarting and relaunching and canceling, you know, half the time I didn't know that something else was coming out, or they didn't order enough. And, you know, if you miss it in the comic book shop, you can't exactly go back and, you know, pick up the back issue because it's gone.
That's a lame excuse, Joel.
Well, it takes back to the direct market versus being able to get it anywhere.
I mean, the comic book shop's going to order what their pre-orders is plus what, two or three?
Yeah.
And if you don't get it, you don't get it.
Well, that's been the problem with so many titles. Comic book shops order their comic books so that they arrive on Wednesday and they're sold out by Friday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And if they are sold out by Friday, you would think that next month they would order one copy more to see if they can at least have copies on Saturday.
Yeah.
But most of the guys don't ever think to order that one copy more. If anything, they order one copy less.
Yeah.
And that's why so many comic book stores keep going out of business.
I mean, that's why I've gone to trades. I hardly buy floppies anymore.
That's true.
Well, first run of Spider-Girls from the anthologies is out in a trade paperback right now. and you probably should have had it and read it before you interviewed us. But all I know, Joel, is if I can't get work after Spider Girl, I'm coming and sleeping on your couch.
Like I said, obviously, you don't know that I'm married to a Hispanic woman. I don't think that's going to fly.
Hey, that's your problem, not mine. I'm on the couch.
Like I said, I switched to Spider-Girl during One More Day or Brand New Day and all that stuff. And it was really because my comic shop owner, we had done a podcast on Brand New Day. And he said, he said that he was done with Spider-Man. And if he was going to read a Spider-Man book, it was going to be one that he thought took place in a real continuity. And he said he recommended Spider-Girl to everybody. And that was going to be the only Spider book for him from this point on.
See, Joel.
Well, I hope he still feels that way.
I think he absolutely does.
Did you agree with him when you read the stories?
I did. I have not picked up a Spider-Man book since Brand New Day either, since One More Day.
See, I like you. What's your name?
Adam.
Adam. Hi, Adam.
And yeah, I made the jump over, and I didn't jump back.
See that? No, I can't even expect that from everybody, but we have heard that if you have a problem with some of the modern continuity with Spider-Man, and even Joe Quesada even give an interview like that? If you're not happy with Brand New Day and you want to see a married Peter Parker and Mary Jane, buy Spider-Girl. Exactly. Come on, we're trying to cover all your bases, that kind of thing. So.
Exactly.
We even did that short-lived Mr. and Mrs. Spider-Man feature that Joel didn't see in Amazing Spider-Man Family because an anthology was too much trouble for him to pick up.
Well, I tell you what, if it'll make you feel better, I'll send you a check for $20 a piece to make up for my not buying it.
Joel, this isn't
about
me. You
can send one over here while you're at it.
We are way past the point in this interview of this being about me feeling better, Joel.
Right.
You
now
just spent 3 hours
depressed.
Of my time so you could, punch me in the balls in the last 40 minutes. That's...
Joel, you may have just severed a friendship.
See, Ron, now you know why I don't want to give interviews anymore.
Now I understand, Tom. Now I understand. But
this is my last interview, guys.
You were right. Once again, you were right.
I just took this interview out back and shot it in the back of the head, didn't I?
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
The only way you can make it up to us is all of you guys have to buy the Spider-Girl trade paperback that's out there now.
What are the next shows you guys are going to be at? We'll buy them directly from you.
Oh, I don't go to shows anymore.
Well, I'm not a retailer.
They're worse than interviews.
I'm doing the Pittsburgh Comic Con this weekend.
Are you doing Pittsburgh?
Oh, really?
Yes, I am. I will be there. We will be talking about the Spectacular Spider-Girl, and we're trying to get as many people as we can to buy that book and support that book. That would be you, Joel. And
I promise you, I will go out to the comic shop this weekend and buy 3 copies.
Well, it's not out yet, Joel. You're being a dick about it now. It comes out like May 5th or something. You might want to go, if you go to your comic shop this week, you might want to pre-order one or have them set one aside for you, but you don't have to be dickish about it. You might enjoy it.
How funny it is to see you get steamrolled like this.
It seems to happen once per interview, doesn't it?
Is there any chance of seeing you at a Heroes Con in any time in the near future?
That's up to Sheldon Drum. Apparently, I offended him greatly because he invited me to some shows early on when I was high profile on Spider-Man. But ever since, I've run into him at some other shows. He's a terrific guy. If you've met him, he's a really great guy. And we've run into each other a few times, and it's been like old home week. But there have been no invitations forthcoming. He's too busy dealing with the glitterati of the comics world. I'd be more than happy to show up at a Heroes Con anytime, but I only go where I'm invited. So
understood.
Except for Joel's couch, because that's going
to
happen.
Next year is the last year that he can get me.
Next year.
Next year is the last year.
Why next year?
What?
Why next year?
Because because after next year, my convention days are going to be over.
So they're not already.
No, not quite yet. I think yeah. I still got
a little bit in you.
You know, I think I got one more year, and then I'm done.
Now they had Irwin Hasen last year.
Did they?
Yeah.
You're going to equate me with Irwin?
Yeah, Irwin Hasen.
Well, I'm saying.
Are you kidding me?
I'm saying. Irwin
is just a young kid compared to me.
I don't think that guy's ever going to make it in this business.
Thank you, Adam, for taking the kid off.
Tom's the guy that turned down Dondi. He also told the Beatles they'd never make it. And,
Boy, I want to tell you guys something. A bunch of years ago, I went to a convention. I forget where it was. And Jerry Robinson was there. And they told me, you know, I was there in Jerry Robinson. They said to me, listen, we're gonna give Jerry Robinson a Lifetime Achievement Award. So we'd like you to be there to give him the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I thought, why me? Because, you know, I was the editor-in-chief of Marvel Comics. He didn't work for Marvel. I said, no, because you're the only other guest we have. So I said, okay, I'll show up to give him the award. So I showed up, and they gave Jerry his Lifetime Achievement Award. And I'm standing there thinking, I thought I was supposed to give him the award. And then they turned, and they gave me a Lifetime Achievement Award, too. And I thought, somebody must be talking to my doctor, because... Jerry Robinson retired from the industry 2 years before I was born. And here I am standing next to him. We're both getting Lifetime Achievement Awards. What are they trying to tell me? To retire and get the hell out of this industry now? And I was so morally offended. And that's why I don't go to conventions.
Yikes.
All right, guys. You have any other questions?
No.
Okay.
Nothing.
No.
I don't know if I'm going to dig myself out of this.
You can dig yourself out by ordering two copies of Spectacular Spider-Man number one.
When it
comes
out.
And one copy of the trade paperback.
Well, you better order them now because they're going like hotcakes. Because the last trade paperback, they put extra stuff in it. It was a $25 trade paperback, so that's pretty steep too. But
yeah, that's how Marvel rolls.
Well, you can take that money that you were going to send us because you were so snotty about it. You can take half of that and put it towards the trade paperback and see if you actually enjoy the stories. I don't want you to read them, you know, because you're forced to.
You know, or order it on Amazon.com. It'll be a lot cheaper.
That does kind of seem like Joel would rather just send you guys $20 directly than actually buy Spider-Girl.
You got that. You got that.
I'll take $20.
That's kind of what that
is. Do I have
to
read it?
You just parked the bus on him, Adam.
If this is what the typical comic fan is like these days, then that explains the trouble that the industry's in.
No wonder we can't get work anymore. We write these stories for people who actually want to read them.
You preemptively flame everything.
Guys, I certainly did enjoy this time we had together.
Yes, I thank you.
I'm glad that makes one of us.
Seems we just get started, and before you know it, comes the time we have to say so long.
In all seriousness, I mean, you guys have been on the phone with us for like 3 hours now.
For like 3 hours, yeah. And you know, you've been more than generous.
Yeah, and I thank you guys a lot for that. I mean, like,
were we a better interview than Priest?
We got about 3 hours out of him, too. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, he never shuts up.
But we didn't laugh as much.
No, we did not laugh as much. We did not.
Oh, well, you should always laugh when you're doing an interview about comic books, for God's sakes. Comic is right in there in the title.
In the title.
Duh.
Yeah, have some fun, dude. Come on. It can't all be Blackest Night. There's got to be a Brightest Day in there somewhere. Ryan Reynolds naked, you know what I'm saying? You know, CGI costume. Hey!
This is fantastic.
All right.
Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Very welcome.
This is going to be a great show.
TheDollarBin.net, and I'll keep an eye out for it. But thank you guys very much for doing the interview, and hopefully it'll help push some paper on Spider-Girl, though, you know, only if you cut out the part where Joel doesn't recommend it.
Now, Joel,
Well, not with that attitude.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Joel, you do have all 100 episodes of
all 100 issues of it, right?
I have the full run of Spider-Girl, the original run, and then I have the first 10 issues of the second one. And then because it is the direct market, Diamond shorted my comics distributor for the next 3 issues, and I just couldn't pick them up. And at that point, I just went, forget it. You know, I just can't do it, and I moved over to trades. Yeah, don't even get me started on my Diamond hatred.
Yeah, it's they're not a big friend of us either, are they, Tom? I guess
they're costing you sales.
Well, I mean, most retailers are too. Unfortunately, when there was that one point during the '80s where they were talking about opening up Marvel stores, and some of my best friends were retailers. They're going, how do you feel about that? I'm going, if it'll give Thunderstrike a whole month on the racks, I'm all for it. Because it was killing us. I mean, our sales were good, but it was killing us. We were coming out Wednesday and being sold out by Friday.
Yeah.
We're supposed to have 4 weeks display time, for God's sake.
Yeah, I mean, you sell out by Friday, no one gets a chance to even know the book exists.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it you know, can't help but hurt you over time.
Yeah.
So, you know, if anybody can give me a four-week display time on my monthly periodical, I'm going to go with them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it would be nice if there were enough copies ordered so that if somebody came in 3 days and 3 weeks and a day past the release date, that they could still find a copy, you know, and Joel's a perfect example of that.
I mean, that is how I ended up at the shop that I shop at, is because he always had recent back issues that I could get my hands on.
There you go.
So.
There you go. But yeah, it's definitely an issue. It's a problem, I would love to see the industry address it more aggressively, but just have to play the hand we're dealt. There you go.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, and I look forward to seeing how you edit this into something coherent.
I can assure you
that, guys. We really appreciate this.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Well,
okay. We'll see you.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it was freaking ridiculous.
I almost made it to the end without putting my foot in my mouth.
Hey, what are you going to do? This shit happens.
But you still got to buy the books.
Oh, yeah. Hey, guys, Tom's not gone yet.
Tom's still on the phone. You got to buy the damn books. And more important, you got to read them.
Tom, you were about 3 seconds.
Thanks a lot, guys. I don't know how to hang this thing up.
You hit the little red circle.
Oh, hit the little red circle? Okay, the reason why I was listening, I couldn't figure out how to turn the damn thing off.
I'm just glad you announced before we started bad-mouthing you, so.
He's gone.
That was fantastic.
Oh, what a great ending.
Dude, we had a lot of fun with that one, man. I'm not gonna fucking front.